Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello and welcome to Living History. It's not just a regular episode. This is something really exciting we've been wanting to do for a very long time. Anzac Day is here. It's the most important date on the Australian and New Zealand remembrance calendar, and we wanted to take the opportunity to do a not just a great episode, but a special series about Gallipoli. It's the most famous Australian story. It's the one that everyone wants to know about. It's the reason we commemorate Anzac Day, and so we wanted to do a special series of episodes. So we have not one great episode coming up, but a series of eight episodes coming up to talk about Gallipoli in depth, breaking it down into all its component parts, exploring it, discussing it, probably over-discussing it. And the person that's going to be over-discussing it with me is the one and only Mr. Peter Hart. Pete, I'm very excited. Welcome to this special series.
It's very exciting to be involved. I'm very pleased. And what a story we've got for everybody. I hope they enjoy it.
It's going to be great. I can't wait for it to unfold over eight episodes. We're not just going to focus on the Australian story, not just on the New Zealand story. We're going to tell everyone's story because, as we always say, Gallipoli was a collaboration. Everyone did it together. Everyone struggled through it together. So we're going to tell everyone's story. And I do have to say right at the outset, we are releasing these weekly. So over the next 8 weeks, you're going to hear the whole series. But if you cannot wait, if you want to binge, all eight episodes are available now to subscribers. There'll be a link in the show notes for a very small monthly fee. You can subscribe and get eight episodes straight away and find out the whole story. Did the Allies win? Did the Turks win? Did World War One end in 1915? You'll get to find out the whole thing by subscribing. So there is a link in the show notes if you can't wait to hear all those episodes. Well, Pete, let's jump straight in. The first episode we're going to do, really one that you could almost say this is the point of the Gallipoli campaign. We're going to talk about the naval attack in March 1915, which is a story that probably doesn't get told as much as the landings and the evacuation, but an absolutely crucial part of the story, isn't it?
It is, because to a lot of historians now, if there's one chance of succeeding, it was the attack on the 18th of March. Still only about, what, 1 in 5, 1 in 10? Still not a great chance, but that was probably the only real chance of any success. So it is a crucial part. And it was a tremendous victory, a bit of a spoiler there, for the Turks. And it is amazing what the Turks achieved in withstanding a naval attack by two of the great naval powers, France and Britain. So it was quite a story, and I think it's the place to start.
Well, I don't think we are giving away any spoilers when we reveal that the Gallipoli campaign was an entire cock-up. Your thoughts off the bat, Pete, before we do eight episodes. Was this a good idea or not, the Gallipoli campaign?
It was a ludicrous idea. There was no real chance of success. It was based on wish fulfillment. The people who said that, people like Churchill and the rest of the cabinet who just imagined up benefits, none of which would really have happened. The Balkans weren't all going to come in on our side because they hate each other then and now. We had no arms to sell Russia. They had no grain to sell us. And anyway, there's the submarines and things. The Turks, it was partially our fault they were in the war, taking their battleships. We stole their battleships. And there's just so much. The whole thing is stupidity. They were stuck on the Western Front, and politicians were looking for an easy way out. And in Australia, in Britain, what do politicians do? They look for an easy way out. And it's the servicemen in this case who had to suffer because of it.
Well, it's going to be a hell of a ride as we go through the twists and turns of this campaign. But the story actually starts in late 1914, doesn't it? Long before there was a contemplation of landing on Gallipoli. What was happening in late 1914?
Well, in late October, Turkey attacks the Russian Black Sea ports. And not unsurprisingly, Matt, the Russians declare war. We don't actually declare war until the 5th of November. But before that, on the 3rd of November, Churchill, rather eccentrically, orders the squadron that's blockading the entrance to the Dardanelles to attack, to bombard the forts. And they actually have some success. They blow up the Cedar Bar fort, which you and I have visited. They blow that up in the sense that the magazines set off. They kill about 80, 90 Turks. Turks regard this as a terrible thing, but of course they declared war on the Russians first. So this is started. And this is a fantastic warning to the what would you do? What would you do? What would you do if you were the Turks? It gives it all away, doesn't it? They start to improve their defences of the Dardanelles. It's obvious what they do, and they did.
Let's kick this off with a bit of a geography lesson as well for people that haven't seen it. So we're talking, when we talk Gallipoli, it's a peninsula. I mean, it's really important. It's one of the most important waterways on the planet. It always has been for thousands of years. This is where Xerxes crossed the Dardanelles to, you know, and eventually the Battle of Thermopylae against the Spartans. And I mean, for thousands of years, this has been a crucial waterway. So it's the, correct me if I get any of this wrong, Pete, but it's the waters of the Dardanelles lead into the Narrows, the skinny little bit that separates Europe and Asia in Turkey. And then that keeps going down. It expands into a bigger bit, which is the Sea of Marmara. And that narrows really tidily to the Bosphorus River, which flows through Constantinople, which is today's Istanbul. And then that opens up into the Black Sea, Russian ports, and the whole rest of the story. So if the Dardanelles are closed, the Aegean is closed, and therefore the oceans of the world are closed to anyone trying to get through. And namely, that's the Russians. The Russian Black Sea fleet can't get through when the straits are closed. And by closed, we mean the Turks have got lots of mines stretched across the Dardanelles, and they've got big forts with very big guns on both sides of the water, ready to blast any ship that comes along. So I'd suggest you grab a map if you're not familiar with the geography. But every time we talk about Gallipoli, the Gallipoli campaign, everything that's going on, it's all about the waters of the Dardanelles. Capture the Dardanelles. Anyway, this is the theory. Capture the Dardanelles, capture the Sea of Marmara, and then eventually you can bombard Istanbul, knock Turkey out of the war, and open up an ocean channel for the Russians. How have I gone there, Pete?
You've gone brilliantly, and that's spot on. And it wasn't just the mines and the big guns in the forts as well. You've got to remember they also scattered batteries of howitzers hidden in the folds of the hills, because it's quite complex terrain on either side. And they also had torpedo tubes, and then they had the Goeben and the rest of the Turkish fleet that were there. So it's an integrated defence system. We've given them time to build up something that's quite formidable, and it indeed proved to be so.
Well, the Turks are good at defending this waterway. As we said, for thousands of years they've defended this waterway, long before anyone had even dreamed of a great war. They were very good at defending this waterway. And I think, it shows the peninsula itself, where all the fighting and all the dying would occur, is actually fairly unimportant. It's not a strategically important piece of ground. It's simply the access point to these forts and the mines and the whole rest of it. So it's a fantastic example, Gallipoli, of how objectives unravel, how as things go wrong, your focus changes. And you know, by the time we're talking about, which we will in future episodes, Lone Pine and Battles of Krithia and Suvla, we're a hell of a long way away from capturing forts and sending ships up through the Dardanelles. And, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, Pete, well, I don't want to give the game away, but we can't ignore the importance of the waterway.
No, we can't. And the biggest, funny enough, the main objective is something which you and I climbed up. Remember you moaning like buggery as we climbed up it. Kilid Bahir, which is immediately behind the main fort by the Narrows. And that is what they're actually after. That's what the purpose is. Capture that so that the... that's what the land campaign's about. We'd better talk about how the naval campaign started. It basically starts because on the 1st of January, the Russians ask for help because they think they're doing badly in the Caucasus Mountains where the Turks have sent an army. And that's going off. And instead of telling the Turks, the Russians politely to go away, because we've got the Western Front and the Germans to fight, we instead decide that we'll send the Royal Navy and the most ludicrous, say what you think of it, the most ludicrous command ever. The Royal Navy to invade and take the Gallipoli Peninsula with Constantinople as its objective. How realistic does that sound from a shippy thing?
It sounds absolutely ludicrous. The thing that strikes me is how early that was, January 1915. They're already talking about take the peninsula, and the objective is Constantinople. Now, I've looked on a map. That's 250 kilometres away. That's a long haul away from where they're going to land or where ships are going to begin that journey.
Yeah, it's ludicrous. And they also, there's no clarity of thinking in the British in London at all. No clarity whatsoever. And it's sensible enough they're going to put a couple of battalions of Royal Marine Light Infantry. They're going to go with them to make the landings to destroy the forts, which will have been destroyed mainly by the ships. But then Kitchener, who was Secretary of War, also decided... I like the way the Secretary of War. None of this nonsense they have now, Minister of Defence, Secretary of War.
Yeah, there's he's not the Grand Chancellor of Peace, is he?
No. He promises troops for the later stages of the operation. So, and this is where we get things... it just all spins out of control. The Admiralty is not keen. Let's give you a quote that sums up the Admiralty. Fisher, the First Sea Lord, is away with the fairies and not really coherent at all. But one chap who is fairly sensible is Admiral Sir Henry Jackson, and he says, "The naval bombardment is not recommended as a sound operation unless a strong military force is ready to assist it, or at least to follow it up immediately the forts are silenced." Now, they sort of move towards that, but they don't really move in a coherent, sensible fashion. And the troops they assign aren't suitable. So the Royal Naval Division is eventually sent out in February. They're not trained troops. They've got no artillery. You know, there's an old expression, if they don't know their arse from their elbow. And that's what this lot are like. Although it's best not to mention arses too much with the Royal Naval Division. But the Anzacs, it's up for you to assign what level of military competence you think the Anzacs had in, say, February 1915. What do you think, Matt?
Well, I don't want to offend anyone, but I always like to fall back on the term enthusiastic amateurs, which really explains the Australian Imperial Force. It had been raised in a hurry. They had picked very good quality of people. You know, yes. It was only the brightest and best. You had to be 6 foot tall and a chest like a barrel and, you know, good teeth and all that sort of stuff. You would have fitted in perfectly, Pete.
How does that explain the 27% of British who are there? Because, you know, us British are all short and weedy and
even if you
have
a good system, you know, the undesirables sneak in, mate, don't they? But, no, it is a good point. Yeah, exactly. One-third of the Anzac forces, between a quarter and a third, were British-born. And a lot of Aussies fighting in the British forces as well.
I think the solution is the moment the British arrive in Australia, they grow 5 or 6 inches and get much bigger penises.
You've never been to Australia, have you, Pete?
Oh, I went briefly. 2 days. I had to leave.
So you felt the effects in 2 days, did you?
Just a bit.
But I mean, this is not an insult to anyone, but I mean, an army is an organic, living, breathing thing, and the people that join it at the start are not going to be as well trained as people later on. The systems are not going to be in place. And as we know, the First World War was a new war. There hadn't been a war like this before, and it took people time to get their acts together. Enthusiastic amateurs is how I would describe it.
People often talk, Kitchener eventually hums and haws, eventually adds the 29th division. But the 29th division, is people often refer to it as a regular division. It wasn't. It was battalions scraped up, and I use the word carefully, from all around the globe. They hadn't ever served together, hadn't ever trained together, and they also are not that competent. So, you know.
I mean, they're we should say these troops are only coming together for the Gallipoli adventure, as we will call it, because they were on hand. The Anzacs, the Anzacs were supposed to be heading for the Western Front, but there wasn't space for them in depots in Europe, in the UK or France, so they stopped in Egypt. There was a fear that the Turks would attack the Suez Canal, which they did. And so, it was convenient to have the Anzacs garrisoning Egypt, British troops there as well. And so, when this great expedition came up, it just made sense to grab the closest available troops, who were the ones in Egypt.
So this muddled thinking means that any idea of it being a single service, a Royal Naval assault, has been compromised. It's not really like that right from the start. It is muddled thinking throughout. And if you want... I mean, there's an expression of bugger's muddle. It really is just bad, that the whole of the thinking behind the Gallipoli campaign. Now, Churchill asks the local admiral, Admiral Carden, I can't remember his first name just at the moment, to produce a plan. And his plan is hilarious because it's just a list. So first we'll take the outer fort. Then what? Guess what they do then? The middle fort. Can you guess what they do after that? Yeah, the narrows fort. And then they'll go through and take Constantinople. It's not a plan. It's a list.
We've discussed this several times, and our rather flippant version of this is you take the outer forts, you take the middle forts, you take the inner forts, then you take the Sea of Marmara, then you take Constantinople, and then it rains beer. Or whatever, whatever the next ludicrous expression is.
It rained beer on us. I'm just easily distracted Pete, they call me. I remember it raining beer on me and you in Constantinople or Istanbul, as we should call it.
It was a terrible plan. What we're saying with all of this is it was a terrible plan. And I've just finished a book about Gallipoli, so I've been up to my eyeballs in quotes and facts and figures about it. And the one thing that struck me, which I said in the book about the whole thing, is that the Allies played Gallipoli like a gambler who sits down at the table without enough money in his pocket. That's the best analogy, that they sit down, they join the game, to use the gambling analogy. They don't have enough money to keep up with the wager, and so a little bit later they get some more money. But that doesn't give them advantage. Now they've just caught up again, and then the game moves on. And they keep playing catch-up, and they never have enough money. And that's the frustrating aspect. We've got to get back to talking about the naval battle, but if from both the land campaign and the naval campaign, if they'd had better assets, in fact, the assets they had late in the campaign, if they'd employed at the start of the campaign, it would have gone very differently. But of course they didn't. It was very piecemeal. They put things together bit by bit. It evolved as it went on, and what a disaster. That's not a way to run a campaign.
It's not. Now, we'd better go. So, 19th of February, they start, and the Allied fleet, the French, and mustn't forget the French, because they're there throughout, the Royal Navy and the French, Shell, Sedd el Bahr, Cwm Cali, and Orkney forts. Now, they're the outer forts. They're the ones at the edge, if you like. They have little impact. Now, I was going to ask you why you think that might be, but I always love to ask Gary questions. I know he doesn't know the answer to, but I think you probably do. But why no impact?
I think it's a tough call to hit a fort from the deck of a ship. I think that's a problem.
It is. And the other thing is, naval shell fire is flat trajectory, so you've got a very small sort of aperture to get through, if you like. It's just difficult. They're not used to firing at static targets. They always practice sailing along. It's just really difficult. And then the weather gets worse, and that buggers up operations. And they have a week off. 25th, they try again. 28th, they start to move into the straits with pre-dreadnoughts. They're firing at the forts that start to move up to engage the intermediate forts. We've been to these places, Dardanos, where you held the the 100th anniversary thing. That was fantastic.
Yeah, we held a service for our passengers who didn't get to go to the official service in 2015. We held our own service at one of these forts that we're talking about, one of the defensive positions that the Turks used to fire on Allied ships.
Yeah, that's what they call an intermediate fort, and Masudia. And so they're doing that. They also start to send naval landing parties, Royal Marines, people like that, to complete the destruction of the outer forts. And I always compare this to, many's the time you must have been in a pub engaged in argument with a fellow chum, and I call it the prod. And if you're engaged in an argument, it's like you prod someone with your finger. You might get away with it once. You might get away with it twice. The third time, you'll get your finger broken and you'll get thumped. And that's exactly what the Turks do. They basically, first time, they're a bit caught by surprise. Second time, bit better resistance. Third time, it goes badly. And this is again, the analogy that you were mentioning. It's almost like we're taking them through. Now, you need to improve your defences a bit, because if you don't, we're going to do this. Oh, yes. Well, we'll put some barbed wire out. You know, that kind of thing. Anyway, by this time, they have got this integrated defence system. And the big guns threaten the battleships, the pre-dreadnoughts. The howitzers threaten the minesweepers. One shell from a 5.9-inch howitzer is going to sink a trawler, which is what the minesweepers were. Don't think of a minesweeper now. It's just the torpedoes. We don't even get that we're there. Everything. It's just the system is all there. So what did they decide to?
Well, I just want to add something here too, Pete. That naval ships are designed to operate on the open sea. That's what, from the moment they're conceived and they're built, they're designed to, you know, they've got ranges of 12 miles they can fire their shells or whatever it is, you know. They are designed to spot targets on the horizon and blast them at long range. Anyone who's been to the Dardanelles will note it is tiny. Those crew on those ships must have felt like they were fighting in a bathtub, because it is a tiny area to operate ships in, ludicrously small, a very narrow waterway. It must have been awful for those ships to try and manoeuvre in that tiny space.
It must, and you could sense the fears. They have Churchill is back in London going, go, get a prod, get on with it, get on with it. Carden's getting more and more stressed, and eventually they hold a meeting 13th of March to discuss the idea of a rush through the Dardanelles. And one of those who attended, let's do a quote from him, and it shows you the fears about just what you were talking about. Commander Worsley Gibson, who's from the HMS Albion, and he says this, it would be madness to try and rush them. The Narrows are sure to be mined. It has been proved that bombardment silences forts, but does little material damage to guns, and only silences because gunners take cover. Personally, I feel sure that it is pressure from our cursed politicians on the Vice Admiral which is making him even consider such a thing. A large army, 60 or 70,000, is collecting for the purpose of cooperation. The only way to tackle this job. And why not wait for them? This is what you're saying. This is the gambler. Let's go. Let's get betting. Let's get started. Don't bother having a coherent plan. Let's just get going.
It's just ludicrous. And the quote that we always hear about the naval battle, and all of this is building up to a very big naval battle, which will take place on the 18th of March. But the one thing we always hear about it is that because the Allies didn't want to invest too much, they would send obsolete ships. They would send to fight in the Dardanelles. The theory being that if they got into trouble, why would we miss them? We don't need them elsewhere. But the point I always come back to is the ships might have been old and obsolete, but the crews weren't. The crews were young and sailors, and every person in a war doesn't want to get killed. And this was quite an ordeal. And I actually have a quote here, Pete, to describe just what it was like to be on one of these ships. This is from Midshipman Herbert Williams from HMS. I never say this word right. Agamemnon. How did I go? HMS Agamemnon.
Pretty good.
So this is what he said about this manoeuvring in the Dardanelles. We were being fired on by concealed howitzers. They are beastly things to deal with as they fire from behind a hill, and all you know about them is that shells are falling all around. You can't even tell from what direction they come from, and so it is impossible to hit back. When these batteries are located by aeroplanes, they move. Luckily, they are not big guns, but this high-angle fire is very objectionable as the projectiles come pretty nearly straight down onto a ship's deck and the side armor is no good. I mean, that's, again, we just come back to the point, this is not what Navy ships are designed for, obsolete or not. The naval vessels are not designed to operate in narrow waters with concealed and movable howitzers blasting them away. It's the whole thing's madness. The more we look into this, it's a word I'll use a lot probably in this series, Pete, it's just madness. I mean, they should have called it off after the first couple of run-ins with mobile batteries, shouldn't they?
They should, but funnily enough, then people like Kitchener are worried about how this appears in the Muslim world. So they're going to make it even worse. At this point, Carden loses, he becomes ill. Basically, stress. Okay. And I can understand that. He's placed on the sick list. He's replaced by Vice Admiral John de Roebuck. And they come up with the idea. It's not really a rush. It's more, you know, the list of that we had, the plan. They're just going to do it in a single day. So it's a sort of accelerated process of the list. Should I go through the plan?
Let's do this. So this is the plan. So they've decided. So there's been all this preliminary stuff. The Brits and the French have been teasing the Turks a little bit with a blast at a fort here and a blast there and a bit of a raid here, warming them up that something's going on. And then they decide, finally, let's get on with it, boys. 18th of March, let's just do it. Let's charge into the Dardanelles and knock the Turks out of the war in one fell swoop. That's basically the theory, isn't it? But there was a system behind it. So why don't you break down exactly what they were going to do, Pete?
Well, we're going to have three lines, imaginatively, line A, B, and C. I like that sort of thinking. That is good thinking.
Better than 1, 2, 3.
Ah, yes. In the first line, they're going to have the most modern ships. Now, one of them was absolutely super modern. It was a super modern battleship, the super dreadnought, the Queen Elizabeth, which has been sent out to calibrate its guns on the Turks. it wasn't allowed to go any past the Narrows because it's too valuable. The other ships in the front row are also pretty modern, the Agamemnon and the Lord Nelson, which actually were built after the Dreadnought because of schedules, and they're pretty good ships. The Inflexible, which is a battle cruiser, and the Prince George and the Triumph are two crappy old pre-Dreadnoughts. They'll guard the flanks. They would sail up the straits. They're going to open fire at the forts either side of the Narrows. That's their job. The next line, this is a British plan. So who are we going to make the worst, give the worst job to? The French. People who say we don't hate the French, boy, they've got reason to hate us. The second line, line B, is made up of the French ships, the Suffren, Bouvet, Gaulois and Charlemagne. They're going to when they've suppressed or things are going well, they're going to pass through the first line, line A, and press forward and get as close as 8,000 yards and really hammer the fort. And then the third line, line C, is the ocean. They're all pre-dreadnoughts, pretty old. The ocean, irresistible, Albion, Vengeance. Oh, by the way, all the French ones were old pre-dreadnoughts as well. The Vengeance, Swiftsure, and Majestic. They're going to be relieved, replace damaged ships, and allow them to press forward. After a couple of hours, the minesweepers would go in. They'd clear all the mines and then allow them to get even closer. And then they'd all withdraw and they'd complete the destruction on 19th of March. And everything would be fine. What could go wrong with this brilliant scheme?
It sounds complicated. It sounds unlikely to work. What's your opinion of this plan, Pete? Because it seems ludicrous. It doesn't seem like it's got any hope of working.
Well, against an integrated defence system such as the Turks had, and with the men of the courage, determination and good leadership that the Turks had, because we mustn't always think, and I know you don't, we mustn't always think that everything's decided by us. Because in this, the other side have got a say, and the other side have got a big say. The Turks have a big say in what happened. They performed brilliantly.
I mean, this plan, Pete, reeks to me of that overconfidence, of the that's a polite way of putting it, the arrogance that the Turks were going to run away. And in the early engagements, perhaps the Turks didn't perform as well as they could have. And it gave the Allies, I'll say us, it gave us this confidence that Johnny Turk is not going to stand and fight as soon as the guns start blasting. The guns of the Royal Naval, the senior Royal Navy, the senior service, as soon as a few heavy shells lands on his head, he's going to run off screaming. And every decision, it seems, every plan, every process was based on this arrogance that the Turks won't stay and fight. And it only took one variable to go wrong, and that was the Turks did stay and fight. They stayed and fought during the naval campaign, and they absolutely stayed and fought during the land campaign. Is this just a British thing? Is this a part of the colonial roots? Is this that, you know, you'd been chasing Zulus around Africa for so long that, you know, there was just a feeling that no one could stand up to the Brits?
It is just natural arrogance. Hubris, I often call, if I want to use a posh word. It's just the way the British were. We were better than everybody else. Remember, we think we're better than the French, the Russian. We think we're better than everybody at that time. It's just the way. It's not. There's no point shouting at people about it. It's just the way the British were. And we get it knocked out of each other, out of ourselves, around about the 1st of July 1916. When we start to realise that the Germans might be good. And we get to know the Turks are pretty good quite early. Because it's not just that they fought bravely. They also used their brains. Because there's something that we haven't mentioned yet. 10 days earlier, March the 8th, the Turks do something really bright. They'd seen us manoeuvring in Erin Kuy Bay, which is just in front of that hotel you used to stay at. That hotel used to look out onto Erin Kuy Bay. And they'd seen us manoeuvring there as we're bombarding the fort. So they plant a line of 20 mines across it, not across the straits, but across the entrance to Erin Kuy Bay. Cunning
running parallel to the way the ships would be going as they go up the Dardanelles. And this was the stout little mine layer, the Nusret, which is one of the Turkish heroes of the campaign.
It certainly is.
Which a replica is on display in Çanakkale, the main town in Gallipoli. So, I mean, we shouldn't understate the importance of these achievements to Turkey, to modern Turkey. And there's nothing more important than what would unfold on March 18. And the Nusret was the key to that. Laying the mines perpendicular to the path of the ships was cunning in the extreme, and worked very effectively, as we shall see.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now,
what happened? Let's talk about the 8th of March, Pete. How did this amazing plane go?
It's a lovely day, you know, all sunny and lovely. And what a sight it must be. And sometimes when I'm up at the forts, I look out and you can imagine when you see the tankers and things coming through the straits, you can imagine the three lines of massive ships, the attendant destroyers, the minesweepers appearing at the entrance to the forts. You can just picture it in your head.
Well, it's 16 ships, isn't it? That's how many ships. We're talking at 16 massive warships. It is, I believe, if my maths is correct.
I thought it was 18, but then I'm terrible at maths. So
it's either 16 or 18, but it's a lot of ships and the minesweepers running around and, you know,
and the destroyers and close,
Pete. Very, very close. If you wouldn't even need binoculars to be standing on the shore and see what these ships are up to. It's ridiculous. I don't even know how those ships fit in the Dardanelles.
Not that many, though. Maneuvered. Well, they move in at 10:30 and you could imagine the gun crews. They just leap. They're down in the bowels of the ships, in the turrets, and there's a sort of people don't realise how complex it was. And they opened fire on the forts at about 11:30. And you've got a quote from Midshipman Alfred Langley of HMS Lord Nelson that you're going to read.
Yeah, and what a quote this is. Load with... is this lyddite? Is that the word? Load.
That's it, yeah.
Lyddite, okay. Load with lyddite shell. In a moment, the whole gun's crews were alert... were again alert and active, whilst the deafening clatter recommenced, only to die away again within half a minute when the guns were loaded. All guns to the ready! Now everyone was tense and silent. It was not difficult to imagine, lying ready to leap into cataclysmic activity, the huge charge of cordite concealed in the chamber of the gun. Unconsciously, one noted that the breech was properly closed, that all men were clear in the rear where the gun would leap in recoil. One wondered if everything was sound. A merely microscopic fault in the great steel barrel might have caused a calamity. The seconds dragged on. Still the soffing? Is that the word soffing?
Soffing, yeah.
I don't know what
I'm
that word is.
I'm glad you got this one.
Rhymes with coughing, but it's got an S. Anyway, sorry, showing my ignorance. Still the soffing from the hydraulic valves and the electrical buzzing were the only sounds inside the turret. The waves breaking against the side of the ship could be plainly heard. Suddenly, two rings on the fire gong. Stand by, one ring, fire, and with a crump, the gun would leap back into the turret and start slowly to run out. The air in the gunhouse, suddenly compressed, then released by the great mass of the gun, was rent at the same time by the noise of the explosion. Before the reverberations had died away, the gun's crew, with febrile activity, were reloading.
I'm so pleased you got that.
I can see why you gave me that one, Pete. He's quite a wordsmith. But
it's just an accident.
But that's, I mean, that scene, the gun loading, the tension before the gun fires, the air compressing as the gun explodes, and then the explosion, just, oh my God, I shudder at the thought of it. It just, and this is happening dozens of times, then hundreds of times. Guns are going off all over the place. Extraordinary.
Well,
imagine what this looked like, Pete. Imagine the scene. Forts, howitzers. Pete's just knocked over a lamp in his excitement. Forts, howitzers, the ships all blasting away. Just hell on earth. Just extraordinary for both sides.
Now, we've got another quote from the inside of a 6-inch gun turret, because those pre-dreadnoughts have lots of different type guns. This is Private William Jones of HMS Prince George, and he says this. There were 8 of the crew and 2 by the ammunition hoist. We were in that casemate 11 hours. It's about 14 feet wide and 12 feet deep. Inside, it was very hot. Some of us were very scantily dressed. I was wearing a bathing costume and a pair of heavy boots in case a projectile dropped on me toes. The old fellow, a corporal of the Marines with a very heavy moustache, poor old chap. We gave him the lightest job that there was, but out he went. He was right out, means he fainted. The gunlayer sergeant said, "Leave the old bastard alone," and we carried on. When we loaded the gun, it was quite a big job because the shell was about 112 pounds. You open up the breech of the gun, pull the breech back, up comes a number 4, he gets a shell on top of the shell guide, gets a rammer, rams home, number 6 comes along with a cylinder and enters a tube, pushes it right home, number 2 closes the breech, ready! Immediately you stand clear from the guns and it's fired by the number 1, the gun layer. Then open the breech again, get the extractor on your arm that fits around the back of the cartridge and you fling it aside. I can assure you it's red hot. And the whole procedure has gone through again. So there's the massive big guns that you described, and then there's the little 6 inch is not a little gun, by the way. It's a bloody big gun. So the British Line A, they're advancing into the Straits. If you remember, the Prince George's one on the right or left-hand side, they're the flank guards. The howitzer fire's beginning to build up because they can't fire at them because flat trajectory, the howitzers are hidden in folds of the valleys on either side. They can't get at them. What do the forts do? They slow down, they stop. The Turks aren't stupid. They only fire when there's something happening. And this is a thing through the entire Gallipoli campaign. They're not stupid. But eventually, Admiral de Roebuck decides it's time to order the French Line B forward. Now, they're under a chap called Rear Admiral Emile Guiprat. I'm not sure how you pronounce that name. And they're going to pass through and close the range. So the Gaulois and the Charlemagne, they move up on the European side of Line A, passing them. And then
so
the
that's
Suffren,
the left-hand side, isn't it, as we're heading up the
perfect,
terminal.
Yeah. Yes. Or port.
The port side. Very good. On the port
and
side.
And the
Captain, on the port side.
The Suffren and the Beauvais, they pass on the Asiatic side, on the right hand or starboard side. We've got 3 ways of saying it now.
Look at us go.
These French ships get battered to buggery. That's a highly technical naval term. The fort burst back into life as they get closer range, and the Suffren's really badly hit. And this is a heavy shell penetrates right through to a magazine. A young officer has to close it. Now, this is Rear Admiral. You're going to do a quote now. Can you say his name? It's your own name. So.
This is Rear Admiral Emile Guiprat, I would imagine, on board the Suffren. So that's the best of my French, sadly. But luckily, the quote's in English. So this is what he had to say about the ship coming under fire. A casemate and a turret were knocked out of action, and all of their crew killed and incinerated. Desiring to salute our brave men, I went straight down. The scene was tragically macabre. The image of desolation, the flames spared nothing. As for our young men, a few minutes ago, so alert, so self-confident, all now lying dead on the bare deck. Blackened, burnt skeletons, twisted in all directions. No trace of any clothing, the fire having devoured all. I mean, that just horrific. And, you know, we talk about guns firing, there's explosions going on, but there's shells hitting. There's shells hitting the forts, there's shells hitting the ships, they're starting fires. This is just hell on earth. And it's a short range for the ships, but it's a very short range for the forts as well. The ships are pretty easy to hit.
And if a young officer hadn't flooded the magazine, they would have all been dead, all 600 or 700 of them. That's the point. They're so close to losing the Suffren. Now, the British are watching this, and this is a lovely quote from able seaman Daniel Sem. He's on HMS Prince George as well, and he says, "I say, hats off to the Frenchmen. Two of their cruisers now passed up the lines. They're battleships, but you know. And took up position ahead of our ships over on the Asiatic side in a direct line with Dardanus Fort close to the Chenac. If anyone went over into hell, these two French cruisers did. At times it was impossible to see them for the spray that was thrown up by the shells falling all around them. The fort was firing like hell." And this is the point. The French have got the worst job. And this is, I'm going to be blunt about it. If anybody throughout the whole Gallipoli campaign is badly treated or exposed to unnecessary losses or danger, it's the French from start to finish. It's worth remembering that.
I mean, this is effectively day one of the campaign, and already the French are copying the worst of it, as you say. And it's a trend that would continue for the next 9 months, for the next year, effectively.
Now, so what happens next? Well, something happens, something really serious. At 1400, just about this time, the Bouvet. Now, the Turks say she was sunk by a heavy shell or shells. The British say she was sunk by a mine. It's one of the mines laid by the Nusra. I think it's probably a matter. I think it's that she was hit by shells and hit the mine at the same time.
Well, I think at the time, Pete, there were shells raining down on her. You know, at the time she hit a mine, as you say, she was coming under an absolute hurricane of fire from these forts.
Now, I want you to picture the nearly, it was what, 650, 700 men, what happened to them, and how long it took for what happened to unfold. And you're going to tell us what Regimental Sergeant Major, he's an artilleryman who's been assigned to HMS Prince George because they put a howitzer on one of the turrets to try and reply to the Turkish howitzers. So there's this soldier aboard the Prince George, and he says this.
"We saw an immense cloud of black smoke ascending from the Frenchman's starboard quarter. Almost immediately, she began to heel over towards us, and gradually, steadily and gracefully, she continued to heel till her masts lay on the water. A second or two in that position, then, just as steadily, she continued to heel over till she lay keel uppermost. She was perhaps half a minute in that position, then quickly slid under the water. From the time we saw the smoke till she disappeared was barely 3.5 minutes. No noise, nothing horrifying in the sight. Our imagination supplied the horror."
Now, we have one quote horrific. From a chap on... Boy, it is just awful. A chap called Seaman Sovor Peiro, and he'd been sent to fetch some more ammunition when the explosions, multiple, happened. He says this, "The boat immediately listed to starboard. I was completely covered in the coal dust which came from the bunkers. I went to the signal ladder, and with the second mate, we climbed up. From the bridge, I got myself onto the funnel, which was entering the water." That's always a bad sign. If you're on a ship and the funnel's entering the water, you know you're in trouble.
Something's gone wrong.
"Then I climbed onto the hull again. I believe that the second mate..." This is not funny. "The second mate was trapped, and he fell into a hatchway. From the keel, I threw myself into the water." Now, it's lucky the chap's a good swimmer, but it's touch and go whether he's going to survive. And this is what he goes on to say. "I couldn't rise to the surface because of the tug of the water." That's the tug of the Bouvet sinking, the suction. I was in the water for some time. Then when the bottom of the ship touched the bottom of the sea, I came straight up, either because the ship touched the bottom or the boilers exploded. I couldn't breathe. Blood was coming out of my mouth, my ears. When I was on the surface again, if I hadn't found this piece of wood, I would have been a goner. I managed to get one of the hammocks, and I got it between my knees. I saw another chap crying out to me to save him, and I told him to come closer to me so that he could be on one end of the plank and me on the other. But when the English came to fish us out of the water, I saw that both his legs had been cut off. He died 3 days later. Again, that's a horrible quote. There's no humour. There's nothing amusing about any of this.
When I was reading these notes, Pete, that you put together, that was the quote that just struck me. I mean, it's incomprehensible what these guys went through. It's incomprehensible how quickly the Bouvet was lost. 3.5 minutes. Well, that's extraordinary. I was listening only the other day to a podcast about the Scharnhausen in the Second World War being sunk, and it took like 20 torpedoes and 800 shell shots or something to go down. This thing went down in 3.5 minutes.
Imagine if you're below decks. You've just had it. If you're below decks, there's no chance. They pick up 40 survivors. In all, 66 survive. 638 people died in that 3.5 minutes. And that's what I think that quote you said. You know, our imagination supplied the horror. And there are pictures of the Bouvet going down. I might stick them up when you put this up. And it's just turning on its side, and it's just nothing. But 638, that's a brigade's worth of casualties. And they're not wounded. In a naval action, you're not wounded. You don't get, you know, one of those nice bandages that go on your arm. You're either alive or dead, pretty well. There's not much in between, and often the injuries, even if you're alive, like the poor chap who lost both legs, you're not going to survive. The shock will do for you, all the burns.
And the burns, as we talked about earlier on. That's one thing, whenever you hear about a ship going down, the thing that always strikes you is the burns, the burning oil in the water, the magazines exploding on the ship, wood catching fire. We can't begin to explain how horrific this is. But spare a thought for that. It's easy to read the textbooks and to read the accounts of Gallipoli and say that the Bouvet went down in a few minutes and it was a big disaster. It was a disaster for the battle. It was a disaster for the Allies in terms of their ability to continue making war against the Turks. But think about those poor blokes trapped underneath as they went down in the waters of the Dardanelles. Just horrific. Yep.
Absolutely. And what the Turks have done is they've reserved their fire. They can hit really hard. And there's a nice quote here that you're going to read from. This bloke is Petty Officer George Morgan. Now, he's on HMS Irresistible. Is he on HMS Irresistible? No, he's on the Ocean. Sorry. And he says this. Read us the quote, because it gives an idea of what it's like.
So, Petty Officer George Morgan, we soon began to pay our respects to the forts ashore, giving and taking as fast as we could send up ammunition. No thoughts of anything now but charges and shells. What the dickens was that, said one to me, as a monster shell must have struck the armoured belting. Oh, someone's false teeth have fallen in the shell room, said another. It was like being in a huge tank with a party outside with different size hammers belting away. Every now and then, the ship would heel over trembling, the thump of the propellers going now hard, now soft. The news came down that we were doing good work.
Now,
I've got to mention there the dark humour there. Again, I mean, Pete, you did an entire book on humour in wartime and how it's a laugh or cry.
Yeah.
I can see it on the shelf behind you. But it is, as an aside, it is a coping mechanism, isn't it? They're in this horrific situation. They're describing the ship heeling over, trembling as shells land and as guns fire. Imagine being in the ship and feeling it lurch to one side. You wouldn't know whether it was going to roll back and you were going to be okay, or whether it was just going to keep going, like the poor old Bouvet. And it's just horrific. And again, they rely on someone's false teeth have fallen in the shell room. They rely on humour to get through, because otherwise you'd go crazy in this environment.
Absolutely. Now they're trying to get the trawlers forward to sweep the miners for the mines. They don't find the Nusrat mines. The British are thinking they're floating mines. We'll come back to this. The mines coming down the current. Now then there's a really serious blow to the British fleet in that the battle cruiser, the HMS Inflexible, she's on the right of Line A and she'd been manoeuvring round and she rams onto one of the Nusrat mines. It hits a starboard bow. And her captain, Captain Richard Fillimore, reports the damage. He says this: the electric light failed and most of the emergency oil lamps were extinguished. Men stationed in A magazine and shell room were thrown off their feet. The fore turret was felt to lift bodily. All communications failed and orders to the engine room had to be conveyed by messenger. Speed of the ship was increased to 12 knots and the trim corrected by flooding the provision room. But the ship remained down by the bow some six feet. And she limps out of the strait. Now,
can I just say something there, Pete? Orders to the engine room had to be conveyed by messenger. So the captain's in the bridge saying, you know, hard to, you know, increase speed to 12 knots, and some poor bugger's got to run a message down there. How long is this taking to get these effects in these narrow waters with shells exploding everywhere?
Everything's failed. I mean, imagine down below it when the emergency light, and it's pitch black. And you're locked in, and you have above you, remember, I mean, we know the Inflexible survives, but above you, you've got those hatches battened down. You can't get out unless somebody opens the hatch. You can't open the hatch. She does get away. She limps, and I mean limps, out of the straits, and she runs into, you know, Tenedos, which I always call the pointy island, the one with the big hill, pointy. There's a little tiny island off that Tenedos, and she runs ashore there. Now, back in the straits, another ship runs onto one of the mines, and this time, 1614, this is, the HMS Irresistible. Now, this is lucky. Because a lot of British ships go down, whoosh, but this one doesn't. It goes down slowly, and the Turks try and finish her off, and she begins to drift. She drifts into Erenque Bay. Now, you've got a quote from midshipman Owen Omney. What a name. Omney. Let's go with that.
Owen Omney.
Owen Omney. Anyway, he's on HMS Irresistible. What does he say?
A great shock was felt, which lifted the whole ship up. She at once listed to starboard, having been struck in the starboard engine room, which filled up very quickly, a warrant officer and three men being drowned. The bulkhead between the two engine rooms gave way, and she righted a bit. The order was given for everyone to come on deck.
Now, you see, this is lucky, because she doesn't sink quickly. The crew are evacuated. There's no particular casualty. You know, there are casualties, but it's not the 648 or 58 dead, like on the Bouvet. So they're evacuated. Now, at this point, de Roebuck throws in the towel. He orders the leading ships to fall back, and then orders a general recall at 1750. His real fear is not just the fort by this time. He can't understand why ships keep hitting mines. And he thinks, well, they must have invented floating mines that are coming down at us. And he can't face it. And at this point, something surrealistic happens, because the ocean, a pre-dreadnought, it had been trying to take Irresistible in tow, part of which involved circling round it. Guess what happens to it?
Well, we're going to hear from George Morgan that I quoted from before on the ocean. It's
a mine, doesn't it? I can tell.
I'm laughing. I'm not laughing with humour. I'm laughing with the shock and the foolishness of the whole thing that they put these ships in this position in the first place. So here's what happened when Ocean, now, is this the fourth ship to now hit a mine?
Oh,
bang!
God.
The force of the blow picked me off the floor with the 85-pound half charge in my arms. We didn't need to ask what that was. The order came, close magazines and shell rooms. The men all went up the trunk from the magazine. Before I could leave, it was my duty to see all ventilators and bunker plates fastened and watertight, doors shut and voice pipes shut off in case they wanted to flood the magazine to avoid explosion. It only took a few minutes, but it seemed such a time to me. At last, it was finished. There was only one way for me to escape, and that was through the shell room escape hatch. I only had a few minutes. I had to retrace my steps and undo and refasten all I had done. God, the poor bugger. I hurried. Any moment they may flood the magazine. As I opened the shell room door, I heard a faint hissing and a rumbling noise. It was dark now. The electric lights were smashed. It was the swishing water and lumps of coal rolling about in the bottom of the ship. Then the danger I was in dawned upon me. I had to think and act quickly. I crossed to the shell rack and scrambled up on the shelves. Up I went and groped for the hatch. To my joy, it was opened. I was soon through and closed it behind me. My troubles were not over. Supposing the other hatch was closed? Anyone seeing it open passing would close it. I lost no time but rushed towards it. Just as I reached the ladder, I heard someone raising the catch to let it down. I yelled, and whoever it was didn't stop to argue. I was soon through.
Now, that was the quote that most spoke to me. I just can't imagine being trapped beneath decks like that. That's what I was referring to, beneath those armoured hatches.
And trapping himself, having to go around and close all of his only escape routes, and then go and open them all up again, and then close them again just so he could get out. Horrific. Horrific.
Again, she went down slowly, and the crew were basically got off on the destroyers. They're rescued, and she eventually sinks about 7:30, 19:30. Now, what should they do next? Now, this is where the controversy comes, because they retreat after this. The whole lot pull back. One person was de Roebuck. John de Roebuck's chief of staff was a chap called Commodore Roger Keyes. Now, you're a Second World War man. You've heard of him. He was in charge of all sorts of things, combined operations and things in the Second World War. For a while, he was totally incompetent, so he was removed. But he says this. I love the way he gets it entirely wrong. He thinks this of the Turks. A beaten foe. I thought he was beaten at 2 p.m. I knew he was beaten at 4 p.m. And at midnight, I knew with still greater certainty that he was absolutely beaten. And it only remained for us to organise a proper sweeping force and devise some means of dealing with the drifting mines to reap the fruits of our efforts. Now, do you think he's talking bollocks?
Oh, it's self-delusional. At 4 p.m., he knew he was beaten. That's when ships are crashing into mines and men are dying all around the place. I mean, how is that possible that Roger Keyes had that impression of the battle at this stage?
He never lost it. He always thought that they could get through, but actually they hadn't got through. The 16 Allied ships.
16 ships, there we go.
Three had been sunk. That's gone. And three more were severely damaged. So they've lost effectively a third of their force. And what have they achieved for this? And there's a lovely, sardonic, sarcastic bastard. I love these people. They bring joy to my heart. As you see, cynical bastards in the pages of history. And you're going to be Lieutenant Geoffrey Ryland, who was aboard HMS Ark Royal. He wasn't there. He was offshore, you know. But what does he say? And it's brilliant what he says.
I think this is probably the most important quote that we're going to read in this episode, because it just sums up the situation so brilliantly. He said, "There is considerable uncertainty, though, as to how much damage the forts suffered. It is true one cannot make omelettes without breaking eggs, but it is bad if the eggs are broken and the omelette is not made. The question is, have we done three ships' worth of damage to the forts?"
And the answer is no, because naval shells, when they fired at Seddel Bar back in November, they were lucky they hit a magazine. They did no such damage on the 18th of March. Yes, they killed people. Yes, they damaged things, but they didn't knock the guns out. And Churchillian, and they are, Churchill's apologists, have always tried to cast this as a victory. If only they just carried on, they'd have got through next day. And Keyes never changed that view. Hamilton never changed it. People never changed their view. And the victory was cast away by their refusal to push on hard next day on the 19th of March. But how would you sum up the situation?
It's carnage. It's a miracle they didn't lose more ships.
It is.
To get away with a butcher's bill of three ships sunk and three damaged in the face of that onslaught, given what they were asked to do, the ludicrousness, is that even a word? But the ridiculousness of the plan, it's a miracle they only lost six ships. Yeah. It's just the thought that the next day they just pick up and carry on. We've even heard all this rubbish that, oh, the Turks were low on ammo, so they couldn't have kept up the fire. What a heap of bollocks. This was
they were slightly short of modern ammunition, but they had plenty of old ammunition, which was good enough. And the other people, somebody was running short of ammunition. That's the British, because ships can only carry so much. I just want to say this: the forts, they're a bit battered, but they're still standing. The minefield, the main minefield, was intact. The howitzers, they're still plying their deadly trade. The torpedo tubes, we haven't even got anywhere near yet. And round the corner is the Goeben and other ships of the Turkish fleet. It's just... Do you think there's any chance, if they had gone again on 19th, do you think they'd have succeeded?
Oh, it would have been a repeat, and except this time they would have lost more ships. The mines were still there. As you say, imagine once they confronted the... imagine firing a torpedo across the Narrows. I mean, you couldn't miss. You couldn't miss in that space. Because the only thing ships have to defend themselves against torpedoes is manoeuvrability. In those narrow waters, there's no manoeuvrability. And then once you get through all of that, so somehow you dodge the mines, somehow you make it past the torpedoes, somehow you don't get blown up by the forts, the Turkish fleet is waiting for you in the Sea of Marmara. You've then got a naval battle, again, in a tiny waterway. The whole thing was ludicrous. I mean, I don't want to go... I'm starting to sound a little hysterical about it, but it just inflames me so much. But the question that really has to be asked, Pete, is why didn't they call the whole thing off at this point? Why didn't they just say the plan was to charge through the Narrows, knock Turkey out of the war, you know, a sneaky right hook, you know, take the Germans off guard, all of those things. Why, when the naval battle was such a disaster on the 18th of March, did the Allies just not call the whole thing off?
Well, that's what we say now. But this is where Kitchener comes in. Now, Kitchener had been, as you know, in charge in the Sudan and Egypt. He was obsessed with this idea that we must not lose face in front of Muslims, because half our empire is made up of Muslims. India, other countries, Egypt, of course, Sudan. And it was this idea we couldn't lose face. Of course, we lose more face by then charging into the Gallipoli campaign and getting our asses kicked again.
It's the next stage in that great gamble, isn't it? Where you this is the end of the first round of the game. The Brits have not come with enough resources. The Allies have not come with enough resources, and they're now going to say, "Well, let's double down. We could leave the table, or we could double down." And of course, the way they're going to do that, well, how are we going to take care of these forts? We'll get troops to capture them. We'll land troops who will capture the forts, and then the ships will be able to complete their journey to Constantinople.
What can go wrong, Matt? What can go wrong?
What could possibly go wrong? Pete, it was a disaster. It's rightly heralded as a hugely important day for the Turkish people. In modern Turkey, a hugely important day. You'll see, everywhere you go in Turkey, you'll see March 18 marked there. The main university in Çanakkale, which is the main town in the Gallipoli area, is called the March 18 University. There's a huge sign on the side of the hill on the Dardanelles which says March 18. Quite rightly, the Turks should celebrate what was a huge victory, and sadly to say, the first of many that would come up in the Gallipoli campaign. There's no spoilers there, but as you said, we shouldn't underestimate the contribution of the Turks here. It was a ludicrous plan. We couldn't have done much worse in our efforts, but we were foiled by absolutely heroic defence by the Turks, and a lot of the Turkish gunners were killed as well. And when you go to Gallipoli today, you can visit their graves in cemeteries all over the peninsula. The Turkish gunners who were killed on 18th of March in that huge naval battle. What a disaster! And the first disaster of many to befall us as we go on this journey. But this podcast hasn't been a disaster. It's been fantastic, mate. A great opening chapter to what will be a fantastic series on Gallipoli. And thanks so much for your insights in this first episode.
Absolute pleasure. Cheers, Matt.
We'll see you in the next one.
Hey!
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review for the podcast, and visit livinghistorytv.com for more great history content.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.